to another Medicine 360 podcast, which celebrates where the practice of medicine meets the arts. It's hosted today in Bristol by me, Ishminder Mangat. I'm one of a team of people with an interest in medical humanities. In today's podcast, we will be discussing life, death, writing, and the trials and tribulations of a career in neurosurgery. I'm utterly delighted that we have Henry Marsh here with us today to shine a light on these very important issues. Henry Marsh is someone who needs very little introduction. His first book, Do No Harm, was groundbreaking in its candid portrayal of the true experience of being a neurosurgeon, with all of the successes and failures that accompany it. It became an international bestseller and it's been translated into 37 different languages. His two subsequent books, and finally, An Admissions, have both been Sunday Times bestsellers. Henry's latest memoir, and finally, Matters of Life and Death, examines his transition from doctor to patient, and he reflects on how this has forced him to confront his own mortality. He's been doing medical work in Ukraine since 1992, and he's continued to visit the country since the start of the war in 2022. He was made a commander of the British Empire by Her Majesty the Queen in 2010. Welcome to Medicine 360, Henry Marsh. It is such an honour to be speaking with you today. I would like to start by commenting on something that really struck me as I was reading all of your books. You are so candid about your flaws and failures in your writing. For instance, you talk about smashing a kitchen chair in front of your parents when your son William, as a baby, had a brain tumour, and the reader really gets a sense of your rage and also your anguish in this highly stressful situation. You discuss openly when you accidentally operated on the wrong side of a man's brain. You also describe your regret on occasions when you felt as though you shouldn't have done certain operations, such as in the case of Helene, a young woman who had a brain tumour who you knew was nearing the end of her life. Why have you decided to be honest about these aspects of your life and these parts of your practice as a neurosurgeon?
Well, as in many psychological truths, there's a paradox. You have to be extremely self-confident to stand up in public and say, I get things wrong. And I couldn't have written my books, you know, early on in my career, although the first one, Do No Harm, I did deliberately, I wanted it to be published before I retired from full-time work. Well, I mean, I think the answer is that I wrote the books, it sounds absurd, but it's true, because my wife told me to. Because basically all three books are really slightly altered, rearranged versions of the diary I've kept since the age of 12, which I write in every day. And as the years went by, the diary became more and more, I was writing to myself about my work, and therefore often what troubles one most is when things go wrong. I suppose when I had the book published, I didn't realise quite I was actually doing something rather unusual. You know, I just thought, well, these are interesting stories. And I hadn't quite realised, as I did when the book was very well received and reviewed, that I was actually breaking quite a few taboos. I mean, there's a tradition of medical memoirs by junior doctors of the sort of kiss-and-tell variety, more or less satirical. The contemporary sort of scatological version is Adam Kay's book. But there have been books like that by junior doctors for many years. But dare I say, what was unusual about mine was a book written by a very senior doctor. And it's not really a recitation of success. It's a discussion of the strains of the work, which is what makes the work so important and so exciting. Because, I mean, the triumphs in medicine, particularly in a rather, you know, not glamorous, but a slightly extreme sort of medicine like brain surgery, the triumphs are only triumphs because we have disasters. I mean, usually more triumphs than disasters. But you can't have one without the other. And I rather dislike, although we have to be reassuring to patients and give them hope and not cast them into despair, I don't like doctors who just sort of want all the credit for things going well and then hide the fact, often from themselves, as well as some colleagues and patients, that they do sometimes get things wrong.
And I found, for precisely that reason, Henry, actually, I found reading your books so refreshing and inspiring, because we all make mistakes and it's often very difficult to acknowledge them to ourselves, let alone to other people. And although, you know, you kind of reveal occasions where you might have wished you'd spoken differently or behaved differently, you come across in the books as this incredibly likeable character. And I think it's partly because you really show your humanity. And particularly from the perspective of a junior doctor, it's very reassuring to hear such a senior doctor talk about situations where they feel maybe they should have taken an alternative course of action.
Well, I didn't realise how popular the book would be, particularly with, I didn't write it to inspire medical students. I certainly did not want to encourage people to become brain surgeons. If anything, the reverse. But it did gradually dawn on me, yes, because as doctors, we have to pretend to patients to some extent. You know, we have to pretend to be more competent and more knowledgeable than we often really are, particularly when we're young doctors. You know, patients assume all doctors are perfect because patients have to. It's intolerable to think the doctor doesn't know what they're doing. And as particularly as young doctors, we know that's not the case. So we learn to dissemble and deceive. And of course, as senior doctors, we have to pretend to some extent with patients. But then we also pretend to our colleagues and the medical students and all this sort of, you know, suave self-confidence and polish, which of course is a front. The interesting thing is, it's often based on self-deception. And because as particularly as surgeons, we come under such pressure emotionally from our patients to be, you know, to appear as perfect as our patients desperately want us to be, we end up kind of believing it ourselves, although part of us knows that's not true. So we have this sort of balance of, you know, cognitive dissonance. The point is that what's special about medicine is failure. What's special about medicine is it hurts to be a good doctor. It is difficult. That is the challenge. You know, you shouldn't become a doctor if you want an easy, comfortable life. And one of the many problems is, you know, trying to find a work-life balance. My generation didn't have it. I certainly didn't. But I would probably have been called a sort of workaholic and very driven. And that's changed now, and rightly so. I still go in to teach occasionally. I was teaching this morning in my department. I love it. It's great fun. But my consultant colleagues and working wives, they have to share the school run. Yeah, you know, it's very different from when I was a consultant. But our patients want us to be devoted to them pretty totally. And our families want us to be devoted to us. So it's one of the many difficult balances we have to find. And I don't think this puts off young doctors or medical students. You need to understand it is, if you're feeling stressed and anxious, that is good. You should do, because that's the nature of the work, being responsible for other people's lives. And because of there's so much sort of business managerial ideology has seeped into particularly into the NHS, I think sometimes it's easy to lose sight of this important fact, that being a doctor is difficult.
Absolutely, and I think it's important to feel the weight of that responsibility, as you said, because if you're not, then you're doing something very wrong.
Well, exactly. And then if you don't get upset, you know, but you mustn't get too upset, you know. I mean, it's the word empathy, strictly speaking, means to actually feel almost physically what somebody else is feeling, which we tend to feel as somebody very close to us hurts their hand, you know, you jump in empathy. But of course, that's wrong for doctors. You don't want to be empathic. You know, it's more you need this sort of genuine concern and sympathy, but it is bounded, it is constrained. And again, patients don't want their doctors to burst into tears and get terribly upset. I mean, occasionally showing deep concern, occasionally I'd have to fight to hold back my tears sometimes. And, you know, and you do it with dignity and it's well received. But you don't want to start sort of losing control. You have to remain in charge. And again, it's a difficult balance to strike.
And as you've said, Henry, the stakes in neurosurgery, they are so high. You have to deal with immense pressure, but you also illustrate the glamour and appeal of working in neurosurgery. You've previously described it as one of the great loves of your life. And I really felt, this might sound a bit strange, but I really felt a sense of excitement when I was reading Do No Harm. And I almost felt like I was reading a thriller because you created so much anticipation and suspense. And what for you is it that's so extraordinary about neurosurgery?
Oh, it's the risk, it's the danger, and the fact you're operating on the most complicated known system in the known universe. And there's such a, you know, it's the risk, it's the danger. It's very interesting. I mean, I've always found neuroscience absolutely fascinating. And this fundamental problem, which you have to accept that the brain follows the laws of physics, and yet we just don't understand it, you know, and how physical matter gives rise to conscious experience and pain. And it's endlessly fascinating. And I find that wonderful. Of course, brain surgery is terribly crude. But I mean, the ethical and moral challenges you face are very great. You know, people with frontal brain damage, the impact on the family, you know, it's really very complicated. Whereas people in severe pain from arthritis of the hip or something, it's a bit different. The brain tumours, of course, the commonest brain tumours are cancerous, malignant gliomas. But because of the sort of fragmentation of care, my involvement with the malignant brain tumours was very brief. I'm just a very small part of the process, and I usually wasn't involved in at the end. But I did look after, I specialised in operating on low-grade malignant gliomas. And I'd be looking after patients for many years. Some are still alive now, 20 or 30 years later. Many have died. And I got to know them pretty well. I always tried to see them myself. And I had some experience because my son had had a brain tumour when he was a baby. I understood what it was like to be a parent, and I did paediatric brain surgery. And it's one of the problems about medicine is, I said, we mustn't be empathic in the strict sense. But there's no substitute for personal experience. I don't know what sort of doctor I'd have been if I hadn't had that experience with my son, which, you know, I thought it was very likely he came very close to dying.
And so do you feel it completely transformed how you then responded?
Well, I don't know. I was a houseman at the time. I wasn't thinking of doing neurosurgery. There were other reasons later, which whether my son's illness contributed to that, I don't know. A lot of things in life are chance and luck. We think it was all a part of a rational plan, but it's not. But coming back to medical humanities, given that if we're fit young medical students and doctors, we may have some vicarious experience and illness in the family. Most of us don't. And you need to read books. It's better than nothing. It's not as good as the real McCoy. You know, until you've actually been a patient, pushed down corridors on trolleys and understood just how frightening, humiliating, demeaning being a patient is, it's hard to understand that. I learned an awful lot from my second wife, who's an anthropologist and a trained observer of human beings, who has Crohn's disease and has had a lot of dealings with the medical profession and being a patient. And I hadn't really understood until I met her, this is now 24 years ago, just how grotty hospitals are. No, I've come to hate them intensely. Yesterday I went to the press view at the Royal Academy of an exhibition of the Swiss architectural company, Herzog and de Meuron, who are well known, and they did the Tate Modern. And they are in the process of having built, or done design, two absolutely unbelievably beautiful hospitals, one in Denmark, in North Zealand, and the other a children's hospital in Zurich. I mean, it's just wonderful if it's truly sympathetic design, trying to get away from the hospital as prison.
You've touched on a few different things there, Henry, that I want to pick up on. You mentioned medical humanities. Do you think that the teaching of medical humanities should be essential for all medical students and junior doctors?
If it's done well, yes, I think it should be. Ideally, like in America, would do medicine as a second degree and go into medicine later. So they're older. The decision is probably more likely on average to be a real one. And once you become a doctor, there is this glass barrier between you and patients. Patients will never tell you very much about what they really think or feel. They're so anxious not to disingratiate themselves with you. So it's when we're still students that, in theory, if we're encouraged properly, it's the last chance you have to try to understand what our patients are going through in human terms. And if you haven't got that, well, there are quite a lot of good books nowadays. I wish people would all stop recommending Tolstoy's Death of Ivan Ilyich. I mean, it's all imagined and has a silly transcendent finale.
I personally think that everyone should obviously start recommending your books then, Henry. And you mentioned, of course, and you've alluded to it several times, about how a career in neurosurgery, there are lots of dangers that are involved. It will inevitably involve tragedies in the operating theatre. And you write about patients bleeding to death in your hands or ending up with these really terrible disabilities. And a story that particularly stood out to me in your book was the patient with the really enormous brain tumour. And at that point in your career, I believe it was the largest tumour you'd seen. And you operated on it. And in your attempt to remove it in its entirety, you ended up perforating a very important artery. How, Henry, did you manage to find the strength and composure to continue working?
Well, I mean, I became overcautious then, you know. And it's difficult. This was now 30 years ago, and I was one of three consultants. You didn't really talk to your colleagues in any way, to be perfectly honest. I wouldn't have found it very helpful. That patient had been to see a very eminent neurosurgeon. As I say, ironically, he rang me up and said, "Oh, this is a young man's operation, Henry." So, "Oh, yummy," I thought, you know. "Great man, says I can do it." What I've learnt is, you know, the really vital thing is team working. I think we need, at a fairly fundamental level, get away from the idea of the surgeon as a heroic individual. In modern surgery, particularly now because of the increase in numbers of surgeons and lack of experience, we really need to see increasingly, not just to see it as teamwork, but as collaborative work with another surgeon. And in fact, the lesson I learned from that terrible tragedy was, and this is a long time, I learned this a long time ago, was when I had a really long, difficult case to do, I'd do it with a friend. And one of the big problems of surgical training now is the lack of experience because of the European Working Time Directive. And surgery is a practical craft. You learn it by doing it. You don't learn it by, yes, it's quite a lot of book knowledge required, but that's, you know, that's necessary, but certainly not sufficient. And you know, why, you know, we tend to admire fast surgeons is because on the whole, fast surgeons are fast because they're very experienced. We shouldn't go back to the sort of being permanently on call or every other night, but my God, you learn quickly. But you learned, you know, you made mistakes. And there was I think one of the better things in the NHS now is there's more supervision. But the trouble is there's more supervision of increasingly inexperienced young doctors.
And thinking more about, I guess, some of those mistakes, some of those failures, I think it's in Do No Harm that you mention this, but you talk about how each surgeon has a small cemetery in their mind.
Well, it's a quote from the French surgeon writer René Leriche. I wish I'd written it myself. But all surgeons have inside themselves an inner cemetery. It's a place we all have to go to from time to time. It's a place full of bitterness and regret and contemplate our failures.
And how often, Henry, do you visit that place now?
A day will never pass without my thinking about patients I failed or feel I failed. Sometimes so badly. I was thinking about one today. I was all come out in a sweat of guilt and shame and sheer misery. But, you know, that's the price you pay. It's not destroyed my life. You know, it's compartmentalized. Just like Yeah, it's like an inner cemetery. You go to it. You don't live in it. If you lived in the cemetery, you couldn't do the work. And it's the same with dealing with patient suffering. You know, if you're not genuinely compassionate, you won't be a very good doctor. But you have to be able to switch it off or put it back in a box. When it does trouble you all the time is when it's still fear. You think you're going to get into trouble, you're going to be sued, there'll be complaints, and you feel very frightened and insecure. And then it's quite hard to forget it.
And then you have those awful things looming in your mind. And you're incredibly self-reflective, Henry, and you clearly strive to be this empathetic and compassionate doctor that you're talking about.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you'd have to talk, I'm sure, with quite a lot of patients and families out there who hate me or are very unimpressed by me. You never, it's one of the most difficult things about being a doctor is you never get any feedback on what you are like. I mean, one of the nice things about doing literary festivals is that quite a lot of old customers or families come up and say, you were very nice. But I also know if I wasn't very nice, they wouldn't be in the audience. So it's a very selected group.
But that must be so lovely to hear because you never got it.
No, it's super. You don't normally get that. And if an operation goes well, they think you're wonderful, however badly behaved you were, you know. The more important, I mean, success isn't a problem. In fact, success spoils us. The important one is when things have gone badly. I mean, you haven't necessarily made a mistake, just bad result. And then how you talk to the family and the patient is, you have to learn the hard way. And it's very difficult to know because nobody's going to tell you. I know now your generation gets some teaching, and that's good. I got none at all. You just watched your boss, and that was it. But it's still very difficult. It's a cliche, but somehow you have to have an open heart and always think, particularly when you're at all levels. Because once you're a consultant, you won't see other doctors talking to patients, really, breaking bad news.
You know, you've talked about how you've tried to communicate with patients. What do you think the human cost is of engaging with patients in this way?
I don't know, because I don't know what sort of person or what sort of life I'd had if I hadn't done this work. And I was drawn to neurosurgery because it's dangerous and dramatic and terribly serious. So it was sort of when I was a teenager, I was full of philosophical thoughts and all sorts of things. Sort of when I told family and friends I was going to be a brain surgeon, they all kind of rolled their eyes and said, not entirely surprised. So it appealed to my sense of melodrama and excitement and everything else. I'd always wanted to do something which was important and serious. I didn't particularly want to become famous or well-known. That was a side issue. I wanted to do something which was profoundly meaningful. And I felt this was it. I was right. And the fact I've actually written some useful books about it and given some lectures has made it even more meaningful. So I think I've been very, very lucky. There was only once with a young teenage girl in Ukraine where I made a complete mess and got lost, and she was left absolutely trashed. To get lost in somebody's brain is horrifying. Never happened to me before. And that, you know, if I hadn't, I felt at the time, I wouldn't kill myself because my family and everything else, I'm very well supported. You know, suicide's a very, very selfish act. But I could imagine killing. I felt it was so awful. I felt so bad about it. And the family still were so grateful. They didn't understand I'd completely messed up. That was terrible. But I suspect most neurosurgeons will have had experience, or most doctors probably. The rate is different. I was just reading this very good book by Phil Whitaker, who's a GP and the medical editor for The New Statesman. But he was saying that every GP will have one or two cases a year where they feel they're usually missing a diagnosis.
So I know that you used to keep diaries when you were young. You'd keep them throughout your professional life. And then you started writing, obviously, about the experiences of being a neurosurgeon. Did you find it therapeutic?
Oh, yes, that's why I did it. But it was more than just therapeutic. And people who know me would say I'm a very creative person. And I wanted to turn this extraordinary experience of my life as a brain surgeon, not to publish it. That was never the idea. Or if it did, it was a sort of fantasy after I'd died or something, you know.
And your writing, Henry, is very witty, but also deeply moving at the same time. And another thing I really appreciated about your writing was that you really reveal how you feel about the government, the NHS, hospital management. And I admire and respect that you don't attempt to dilute your criticisms in any way.
Well, I just try to be honest, you know. I mean, I'm not damning all management. Doctors need to be managed, and there's no more management in this country's healthcare system. And in others, in fact, there's rather less, but in the insurance-based countries, probably, like Holland and Germany and France. No, I just try to be honest. I know that this rang a bell with an awful lot of medical colleagues. It's inevitable that it was never going to be a clash between managers, because basically we all know the government introduced management to cut costs. They call it efficiency. It's just about cutting costs.
Well, I found it very cathartic reading your books in terms of seeing your sense of frustration. It's so palpable, and I can really relate to it from my own experiences.
Well, it's got worse since then, hasn't it? Because of the starvation of the NHS over the last 12 years. And it's terribly annoying because, is there no real doubt that tax-funded healthcare is the most cost-effective way, but it needs to be properly funded, you know, as it is in Scandinavia. And it's all tied up with the class system in this country and inequality of wealth. You know, the way to fund the NHS would be to tax property more. But that's, you know, the tradition of Conservative Party and landed gentry and inequality of wealth in this country. It's not going to happen. It may not even happen under a Labour government. And all this endless talk of reform and reorganisation without extra investment, it's not going to work. You know, we pay less per capita GDP than any other major European country. So no wonder the NHS is struggling. And it's a political choice. This is nothing to do with the fundamental nature of the NHS. It's a political choice by a sort of property inequality party known as the Conservative Party.
And with that in mind, Henry, do you think that doctors have a political responsibility?
Yes, I think we do, because, you know, that wonderful quote from Virchow, the German pathologist and doctor in the 19th century, saying that doctors are the physicians of the natural attorneys of the poor. If we don't stand up for our patients, not many other people will.
And it's important for us to use our position of trust and power to speak out against injustices that we're witnessing.
Yes, exactly. Being a doctor is a vocation, you know, should be, and it's a moral challenge.
And I know you said, you know, you didn't necessarily reread your diaries, but in the process of converting some of them into books, when you reflected back on it, did you see yourself differently compared to how you represented yourself at the time?
That's a good question, which means I don't know the answer. You know that trick. Oh, very, very good question. I tried to be pretty honest, you know, and I think one reason why the books are fairly compelling is although they're rewritten and adjusted, basically everything was recorded at the time. There are no false memories. Yes, I've altered some details. And occasionally it's all poetic license. You coincide things which didn't quite happen at the same time. And in the first book, there's a chapter where I operate on a woman with a malignant tumour, but it dies from post-operative hemorrhage, and her father had died from a malignant glioma. And the same list, it may even have been the same list, I can't remember. I operate on a pregnant woman going blind with a meningioma. So there was an extreme contrast. Her eyesight was restored and the baby was delivered by cesarean section. It was an unbelievably happy story.
I love that story.
Yeah, and I may have elided things a bit together time-wise, but on the whole, I think I can generally say I tried to be scrupulously honest.
I think your books are really beautifully written and they're wonderfully descriptive.
Well, I'll interrupt and say, A, you have to read a lot if you're going to write well. Writing well is not something you're born with. I come from a very literate, bookish family. I've always read a lot and I've talked a lot. There's some innate element. But the other thing is criticism. I always say my first draft was about that thick, 4 inches. My wife goes through it, Kate, my best critic, she's a brilliant writer herself, an anthropologist, is then 3 inches thick. And then my agent goes through it, 2 inches. Then my editor goes through it, 1 inch. And every time it gets better. One of my daughters went to the, did the master's in creative writing at the University of East Anglia, which is a go-to place. And she's got a novel coming out, which she's got amazing advances for. It's fantastic. But the critical part of the creative writing course is you write something and then you read it to your group, and then people criticize it. It's hard work. But it's just like in medicine, it's really important. Teamwork is not about everybody agreeing. It's about criticism and then coming up with something better at the end of it.
And so how important, Henry, to you is it to write well?
Well, it was. I'm not writing, I only write for myself. And at the moment, my life is fairly boring. It's very important. I mean, I regard writing as something I take very seriously. And one of the fascinating things about writing, particularly in English, is my French is terrible. My German, although I'm half German, is non-existent. But there are so many ways of saying things. And it's often said that if you translate an English book into another language, the other version is always much, much longer. Because English is based on three, it's Latin, Celtic, and Germanic roots. So you have all sorts of, they say with the Eskimo, the Inuit have 14 words for different sorts of snow, or the Japanese have 14 ways of saying sorry. But I mean, in English, we have that as well. It's huge, huge range. And it's just fascinating. But you're listening to it all the time. And good writing is, it really has to be read aloud. I'm reading it aloud to myself. And it's the same as talking to patients. You have to put yourself in there. You have to listen to yourself talking. And when you're talking, you're actually editing it and adjusting it as you look at the patient and the family.
And it's writing is an ongoing process of constant revision and reflection, just as the practice of medicine is what it sounds like you're saying.
Yes, exactly. I know the GMC says you should all be writing every day, reflective practice. It's helpful. The other thing I share is I went through two periods of my life when I had psychotherapy, one when I was a young man and suicidal over an unhappy affair, Goethe crap. And the other time when my first marriage ended and I was very distressed. And it's terribly helpful, we're all a bit better off for psychotherapy. And it's very standard practice nowadays to be open about one's mental health issues. But life is difficult. And I'm not saying doctors and neurosurgeons should all be weeping on each other's shoulders and blah, blah, blah. But a certain amount of openness. I mean, good colleagues tick so many boxes. If they're going to criticize your decision-making, you'll make fewer mistakes. They're not subject to your cognitive biases. And when you're feeling wretched, they understand. I mean, you don't have against blood talk at great length about a problem. But to know that only your fellow doctors, particularly in your own specialty, understand how awful you feel when patients are doing badly.
I can completely imagine. And I'm just going to shift focus a little bit now, Henry, onto Anne Finally, which was a really fascinating and philosophical journey, actually, into the realm of death and consciousness and what matters the most as the end draws near. And you write about your own experiences there of being a patient when you're diagnosed with prostate cancer. Was that really difficult to write about?
No, not really. I mean, I write all the time. And in fact, when I was, I had this PSA of 130, which is associated with metastatic disease. And so there was a period of a few weeks when I thought, it's really on the cards. I've only got a few months left to live. This could be a sort of rip-roaring cancer. In fact, it doesn't seem to be. I mean, I had my blood taken yesterday for a PSA. I won't get the result for 2 weeks. Good old NHS. So, it's in the back of my mind all the time.
You talked, Henry, about how you realised how anxious and unhappy your own patients must have been.
Yes. And there was one slightly snooty review in The Lancet saying, when I was by someone called Richard Smith, who was the editor of The Lancet, I think, or maybe the BMJ, said, we went through a period of writing articles by doctors when they became patients themselves. And they all said, I've learned so much, I'll be much better again. He said it got very boring. We stopped publishing his articles. And he said my book was in the same category. Well, actually, that's not true, because what I understood was, it confirmed what I knew already, that we only see a very, very small part of what our patients are going through. And actually, we have to be detached. I don't think it's a kind of theoretical question. I went back into practicing medicine now. I don't think it makes any difference to me, because I knew this already. But it did. The odd thing is, now that I'm retired from clinical work in this country, I'm slightly horrified at how detached I was, had to be. And also, I feel a more complete human being now that I'm no longer having to sort of put up this front of both being detached and generating sort of confidence and calm and everything else with one's poor patients.
Because it's such a hard juggle. And you said that it was only when you were diagnosed with cancer yourself that you could see just how great is the distance that separates patients from doctors.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's a necessary distance. You know, I don't... it has to be. You know, there are degrees. It's a balance. And hopefully most good doctors get the balance right more or less most of the time. But the whole idea about balancing is, you know... You get it wrong, you compensate, you know, it's not static, it's dynamic.
But why doesn't knowing that this is so help us to address the problem or accommodate it? Do you think this experience that you've had of being a patient is the only way that you can obtain that kind of knowledge?
I don't know. I think it depends on your personality a lot. There are all sorts of different doctors. One colleague is a very good surgeon, very good researcher, very nice guy, nice colleague. But I happen to know he's just absolutely crap at talking to patients, you know. That's him. He tries, but he can't do it. Well, he can, but I mean, patients find him very remote and detached, and some doctors are like that. So I think your personality has a big impact on it.
And do you think that doctors are better doctors the more that they can understand this difference between us and patients, or do you think they're less effective?
Well, it depends on the work. If you're a heart surgeon and you do your bypass surgery, and then the patient is sent off to the cardiologist very quickly, in a sense, all that matters is you're a good technician. But an awful lot of surgical decisions are a question of balancing risks. And patients ought to be involved in that decision. And if you are insensitive to patients' suffering, you probably won't make very good decisions. On the other hand, the sad truth is some of the great pioneers of new surgical techniques had to damage a lot of patients first. The obvious example is multiple chemotherapy for leukemia at St. Jude's in Philadelphia. These kids are all dying from acute leukemia, so they're going to die anyway. There was no consent forms. You could more or less experiment on them. But these kids were being poisoned ruthlessly by various doctors. And they were heavily criticized. People said, look, these children are dying. You're just making their suffering infinitely worse. And if the doctors involved had been very nice guys and very sensitive to their patients' suffering, they might have given up. They wouldn't have done it, and they had to work out this ghastly cocktail of what was adnasia, about four different drugs, and really put the kids through hell. So it's complicated. As with everything in medicine, there's no simple answer.
And did you find that, thinking again about you as a patient and that transition, did you feel that writing And Finally helped you to reclaim your narrative from the medical realm, or did you always feel like your narrative would be entangled within that realm?
I've always felt a bit of an outsider anyway, because I went into medicine late. Obviously, I'm a doctor and I'm a surgeon, you know. But I've always, that's why I could write my books, because I came to medicine late. And my wife gets very cross when I say I'm a bit more intellectual than the average doctor. She doesn't like the word intellectual, it sounds pretentious. But I obviously, you know, I have quite a complicated background. Before I did lots of things and was a volunteer teacher in Africa and this, that, and the other. And being a patient held no surprises for me at all. I was surprised I was treated just like anybody else, which was fine. But I'm not, if I myself was a patient, I'd be terrified, you know. Famous writer, you know, what's he going to say about me? But no, I was just another old man with prostate cancer. So that was, I accepted that. I thought it was quite funny, actually, if anything. No, I was just very frightened, is the answer. The idea of death and dying. Becoming disabled, and the 2 years of hormone therapy I disliked intensely as well. but it was bearable.
It sounded horrible from reading the book. And I think you never expect, as a doctor, that you will get unwell.
No, you don't. You're right. And that was what was funny, is that I really wasn't ready for it. I didn't say, why me? Because I knew perfectly well the answer was, well, why not? You know? But I still was terribly shaken by it. And I'm still frightened by it, worried by what my PSA will show when I get the result in 2 weeks' time.
And I think partly it's because we feel like we've got this cloak of immunity.
Yes, I mean, it may be we're all like that a bit, whether we're doctors or not. But I think with doctors, it does become more of a problem. And certainly I'd literally sat, I really quite marked symptoms. I could actually feel the tumour. I thought it was chronic inflammation, prostatitis. I should have sought advice about it at a much earlier stage, but I didn't because I was a doctor and I was reluctant to cross to the other side. It's the same when you have, if you have children who are ill as a doctor, very difficult to be a medical relative. You either get over-involved and worry too much or you get too detached. It's very hard to find the balance. It's quite difficult being a doctor yourself and having sickness in the family.
And I really felt a lot of empathy for you, Henry, when you were describing those feelings of, you know, the anxiety, that horrible uncertainty that you were having to grapple with about what would end up happening to you, because none of us can imagine ourselves in those shoes.
No, and the irony is, you know, I'm 73, I'm going to die anyway. So even if my PSA in the 2 weeks' time comes back showing it's starting to go up again, which means then certainly I'm not cured, I could still be alive for a few years. At the age of 73, well, big deal. You know, most of us live too long anyway. And it sounds like a joke, but it's a serious joke when I say that I regard my cancer as vaccination against dementia.
Which was what your dad had.
Yeah, very much so. And the book starts with my having a brain scan, which I thought was a joke. And I'm rather horrified at what a mess my brain looks.
And you described that really disturbing revelation where you saw that your brain was rotting and you expected yourself to defy that process of ageing.
Yeah, it was awful. All these white matter hyperintensities. Not good at all.
But what is lovely is, in spite of that, you came to the conclusion, I think, that you have lived a really rich and meaningful life.
Yeah, no, yes, simultaneous to being terrified. At the same time, I was really very upset. At the same time, I thought, well, actually, I'd be terribly lucky. And I'd always think back to all my malignant brain tumour patients, many of whom were young, many of whom had children, and they were all desperate to live long enough to see their children into adult life, and a lot of them didn't.
And I guess your career's given you that perspective that a lot of people wouldn't have.
They don't, that's right. And I really have no right to complain at all. I've been incredibly lucky. And the important thing is, again, if you understand basic neuroscience, you know that, you know, an adverse childhood experience is early childhood. It's a huge determining effect on the course of your life expectancy, your health. The idea we self-made Elon Musk to this world, who kind of deserve to be billionaires, it's not they've been lucky. And if you accept your success in life is largely luck, it puts a duty on you to try to help people who've been less lucky.
And for you, Henry, what is it that gives life its meaning?
Well, I don't have a religious faith. Never did, even though my parents were observing Christians. I was sort of dragged to Sunday school when I was young, things like that. It just never, you know, it just wasn't part of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age of my peer group. I never lost faith, I never had it.
So it never resonated with you by the sounds of it?
No, but I'm a deeply religious person, you know, in a sense that, you know, I'm profoundly moved by religious music. Then it's beyond words, you know, a deep mystical sense. I think my second book, I describe how I had a series of, what frankly, mystical experiences when I was a teenager without taking, I never took any psychedelic drugs. I certainly have a deep, deep feeling of, I don't know, pantheistic, being part of it. I mean, just sitting in my back garden, looking at the trees and the wind. Then yesterday morning, say I tend to wake very early. I was awake at 5 a.m, and there was great wind blowing. So it was a fantastic sound of trees, like the sea breaking. And then a blackbird singing just outside the window. And it was, you know, fantastic, incredibly beautiful. And I try with my writing to have some passages where I try to convey this intense beauty, which, you know, in one bit which got commented on is describing operating on an aneurysm down an operating microscope, the beauty of that, driven also by excitement and fear. So trying to put that into words is wonderful.
It seems like family is very important to you as well.
Oh, hugely. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, that's what matters most, you know, particularly in old age. And I feel sad for people my age who haven't got grandchildren or don't take much interest in their grandchildren, because it really is, you know, getting old age is a bore. Now, the problem, of course, is climate change and the future of the next generation face. Now, the problem like dying is, I want to know what happened. But actually, I know what's going to happen. I don't want to know what happened. Particularly the parts of the world I know and love, like Nepal and parts of Africa. They're all bringing a run out of water. The mass migration, which we're seeing the advancing edge of, there'll be nothing. And we're all going to have to stand by and watch terrible things happen and say, well, we can't do anything about it.
And planetary health has never been so urgent or important, has it?
No, exactly. On a positive note, you won't save the planet. But I wrote my car off three or four weeks ago, and I could have had it repaired, not a huge expense, but I'd either got the write-off value or a smaller sum to have it repaired. And I'd say, actually, I don't want a car again. You know, I bicycle everywhere anyway. And I'd say, I've now bought an e-cargo bike. I can't, it's wonderful.
Is it the way forward, Henry?
Very much so, absolutely. And you can cycle uphill or against the wind, and it's effortless. E-cargo bike, you can take, including your own weight, 200 kilograms. And they're brilliant. I mean, cars are terrible things. So at the moment, although my wife is rather sceptical, I'm really enjoying not having a car. And I reckon it's cost neutral. I'll save money. I mean, I'll have to hire a car occasionally. But I don't think I'm going to lose money on it at all.
I imagine you're definitely not. I've got one more question.
Yeah.
I'll try and make it one more question, Henry.
Yeah.
Can you just lastly tell us about your work in Ukraine and what led to the development of Hospice Ukraine?
Well, I mean, Ukraine, when I was doing PPE at Oxford, my main interest was communist and Soviet politics for various reasons. So when the Pure by Chance came out to go to Ukraine in 92, to give some lectures, I thought it was rather interesting, you know. I know a bit about this place. And I met a very dynamic, driven young neurosurgeon who ultimately proved impossible. But I kind of had a love-hate relationship with the country ever since. But I knew it was a very important country. I just knew that. Nobody else did. I can say I was very prescient. And it's a combination of going there a lot and having read a lot. And then before the pandemic, because of my neurosurgery, I was starting to withdraw a bit, operate less. And I still wanted to be involved. And I thought, well, I suspect palliative care in Ukraine is pretty rough, which it is. And I'd really made friends with Rachel Clark, who is like me, did PPE, got a first, then became a palliative, went through a sort of personal crisis as I did. Both ended up, so we became doctors to save ourselves. But we managed to go out together in October last year. Got bombed, which I thought was rather good fun. It sounds a bit naff, but Rachel didn't like it.
Rachel said you were terrified, Henry.
I wasn't. That's a complete lie, actually. I was a bit cross. That ridiculous picture she showed him cowering. It was completely not true. And she's a complete ball of fan. They almost started a charity. So it's really all been her work, and I'm not a palliative care doctor. The problem we face now, we raised £60,000 at this, is sustainability.
I think the work that you've both done in setting up this charity is amazing, and I think it will make such a tangible difference to the work of palliative care teams in Ukraine.
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, although palliative care is underfunded in this country, it is, it's where the hospice care originated here, and I think it's done very well. So my interest, in a sense, is the educational part of the work, rather than just buying morphine patches and all fentanyl. And the Ukrainians are fairly old-fashioned and can't talk about death or dying. And
it sounds like there's such a gulf between the NHS and the medicine that goes on in Ukraine. And I think you've really highlighted that in your books.
Yeah, there's a big gap.
Well, I wish I could go on longer because I've really, really enjoyed chatting to you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right, Ish. Good luck with your wonderful career. All right. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to another Medicine 360 podcast. I would highly recommend that you read all of Henry Marsh's books if you haven't already. And if you'd like to learn more about medicine and humanities, please visit medicine360.co.uk. From our team here, we wish you all the very best. Until next time.